of operators or field in a conformal field theory. Now we want to start understanding the relation between that and the Hilbert space of theory. And we see that there is a nice interplay between, as there always is, between kind of the correlation function point of view and the time order product of operators acting on a Hilbert space point of view. And so I really want to exhibit how we can construct states in the usual sense of quantum mechanics from operators in the conformal field theory, and how to construct that given a set of operators, how to construct a full set of states in the conformal field theory. So I want to, today we will discuss, hopefully, we'll finish, hopefully. I want to discuss the interplay between operators and fields, that this is the language that we have been using so far, even though implicitly we know that, and as I'll remind you, the correlation functions or Green's functions are related to time order products of operators. I want to connect that with the Hilbert space picture. So first, let me remind you that this is not something exotic that only applies to CFTs, but it's something that you know from your quantum field theory. So remember that there we have that if you have a Green's function of a whole bunch of, maybe for this argument, think of them as some fundamental fields in the theory, whereby this I mean weighted by some action, that this guy has another interpretation. That's essentially the change from going from the path integral point of view to the Hamiltonian point of view, where you represent this as the vacuum expectation value. So this is the vacuum. So now you have a Hilbert space, and you have the vacuum state, which is the lowest energy state, of the time order product of phi 1, where now you think of these guys as operators acting in some Hilbert space. Okay? For example, in when you look at free field theory, scalar field theory, these are the operators that then you decompose in terms of creation and annihilation operators that act in some Hilbert. Okay. And time ordering, you know what it is. Essentially, it's you have to order operators according to which comes first. You order them with time, and that's what time ordering is. So, for example, you have time ordering of phi 1 x 1, phi 2 x 2 equals phi 1 x 1, phi 2 x 2. If x 1, the time component of x1 is after x2, the time component of x2, and the other way around if the order is the opposite direction. Okay? Very good. Notice that in this framework, of course, is that since we're going from the Lagrangian picture to the Hamiltonian picture, the formalism is not manifestly Lorentz invariant, because I'm selecting a time and a Hamiltonian. I'm specifying a surface from which I evolve my state. So this doesn't look terribly Lorentz invariant, but the whole point of this formalism is that it's not manifestly Lorentz invariant, but it is. But it's equivalent to the usual path integral formalism, which is completely Lorentz invariant. Okay? So here, the language that we usually use here is that we're computing the Green's functions or the correlation function and here the object of study in this, from this point of view, which is just a translation from this picture to the Hamiltonian picture, is the time order product. Of operators. More precisely, the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of operators. Okay? And on the right hand side, these files are really operators in the sense that now here we have a Hamiltonian, right? So we have a Hilbert space with this Hamiltonian act. And these operators, so now in this picture we have a Hilbert space. H, and those phis over there map states in the Hilbert space, so some operator phi maps phi of x, maps some state psi to some other state phi of psi. Okay? And keep in mind, just as a baby example of all of this, just the scalar field theory, where phi has an expression in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And when you act on phi, say, on the vacuum, what you do is you act with the creation operator in the vacuum, and you create a one particle state. Okay. So in the right-hand side, in order to define this picture, what we need is to specify I make it in quotes, a time coordinate, because this formalism of Hilbert space is there even for Euclidean theories, which is in fact what we study in CFT is Euclidean theory. But actually the point is that what you do is you pick out some time coordinate which has the property that t, let's call it t, that t equals constant is kind of an initial value surface. So in the usual case, you say your time equals zero, and the dynamics of the system is determined by this initial value surface, and you evolve the system in time. But we will see actually that that's not the only possible initial value surface that you can have in a field theory. In fact, one that will be very useful, and that, in a way, that's why the tutorial yesterday was about the mapping the cylinder to the plane. You've already seen, which will be a picture where the initial value surface are constant circles in the plane, which we shall describe. And then the point is that once we have this time evolution, we evolve with the Hamiltonians, where Hamiltonian is in quote because we usually reserve the language Hamiltonian for Lorentzian time, but the idea is the same in any framework. So let me remind you a little bit. So the way I want to motivate this is by essentially redoing the exercise you guys did yesterday, hopefully, which was the how to conformally map. And now we're going to do it in two dimensions, I'll tell you how it's very easy to generalize everything I'm saying to higher dimensions. So the idea is that you start with something. Well, you start with a cylinder where time goes up this way. This is an Euclidean cylinder. So it has that this R times S1. A fixed time slice. So let me draw a couple of fixed time slices. At T1. So first of all, this is the past. It's going down. And the future is going up. And here I'm drawing you two fixed time slices. Initial kind of fixed surfaces. Which in this case of two dimensions, the slice is going to be a circle. So for each fixed time coordinate, the cross section of the cylinder is a circle. Okay? Very good. And if you want, I can put some fancy coordinates here. So I can, not fancy at all, but just introduce coordinates T an X, where T goes up the cylinder, and X is just a coordinate that tells you where you are on the circle, so that in particular X has 2 pi periodicity, so this is just the coordinate on the circle. And now what I do is I conformally map. Well, so before saying that, so this is something that you would feel comfortable talking about a Hamiltonian because you have some time evolution and you evolve states from the past to the future by using the unitary Hamiltonian time evolution operator that maps you from a particular initial time to some future time. So let's see what this means in the plane picture. So this is the cylinder. And now we go to the complex plane. And the reason this is very useful to do is that when we go to the complex plane in the conformal field theory, then we can use all the tricks that we know from complex analysis. We can write things in terms of contour integrals, and it looks much simpler. So as you know, yesterday there's a conformal transformation, which is Z equals E to the psi, zeta, which is E to the T minus IX. That maps this, more precisely, it maps it to the Riemann sphere with 2 points removed, but let's just think of this as the complex plane. Where now we want to understand what's happening here with these fixed time slices, how are they mapped under the conformal transformation? So I think that also you answered yesterday. So just by looking at this picture, this circle here at the fixed coordinate T obviously maps into a circle in the complex plane. So we're now in the Z plane. So I want to map this initial value surface to here. And a future one, the one that comes later, obviously the magnitude of the circle will be bigger because the exponential is bigger. So I map it to some other surface like that. And the extreme cases is that if I want to go to the infinite past, going to minus infinity, which is kind of my in state. So if you think of a scattering experiment, we always think of it as you create a state at minus infinity and you measure at plus infinity. So an in state that lives here is that P going to minus infinity. So that maps you to the origin in the complex plane. So this is where the in states will live in this picture. And the out states would live at infinity. So in the Riemann sphere picture, what you would have is that the South Pole is the image of the infinite past, and the North Pole is the image of the infinite future. Okay? Is this clear? I mean, this should be essentially the content of yesterday's tutorial. That's why we did it. So, since we are... Now you can ask the question of how do I do a quantization in this sense of having a Hamiltonian in this picture. So notice that in this picture, I can define a Hamiltonian whose fixed time slices are concentric circles in the complex plane. And essentially, time evolution, which in this picture was just moving you up the cylinder, corresponds to, you make a disturbance here at the origin, and then it propagates outwards. Propagation outwards from the origin is time evolution in this framework. And this kind of quantization where you use the radial direction as time is called a radial, when you do this type of quantization, it's called radial quantization. Which And that, yeah, so actually this was something that was like many good ideas in physics was introduced by Dirac. The fact that nothing prevents you when you're in Euclidean theory to fix, to either choose a usual Cartesian coordinate to be your, yes. Well, time goes this way. Increasing time goes that way. This is fixed space. So but this man, so this image is just what happens when I move this circle at fixed time along this direction. Are you saying that I could have written this way in anticlockwise, or? You could have done that. But this is the one that's compatible with this conformal map. I could have put a plus sign here, for example, and then it would have evolved the other way around. The reason I do this is because then in complex analysis we're used to doing contour integral when you go counterclockwise. But this has no, it's a choice of coordinates. The thing that's important here is not so much this, the orientation of this fixed time circle, but the fact that time moves out like that. Okay. Any more questions? Yeah.
Euclidean, so choosing a time is a bit weird. So when working with like flat background, and we use the fact that RD, we can pull an R out, and we use that to define our time. But if we have a more complex background, can we still
complex background meaning
choose a time?
I think at the beginning in flat space time, you can do it.
If you have RD, then.
Sorry?
Like we saw that, you know, we have RD, we split that as R plus S.
Well, exactly. So that's, in a way, this discussion we already had one day where I showed you that I can write a metric of RD as up to a conformal factor as the R squared plus the metric on the D minus one dimensional sphere, which is nothing but. So in higher dimension, instead of having a cross section, which is a circle, so in higher D. Okay, let me write it here. But I don't know if your question is if I do it with some crazy metric.
Yeah, if we didn't have something as nice as RD.
Well, if you actually don't have an RD, then we might not even have conformal symmetries at all, right? And then I don't know what to say. So, in order to make sense, for this to be very helpful, and the consensus conformal symmetry allows you to be verified, you need to talk about conformally flat space times. Because then you have conformal killing vectors. If you don't have conformal killing vectors, you don't have conserved symmetries, and then it's as hard as solving a random random variety of filters. So here we're talking about CFTs in conformally flat space times, in particular flat space time. Okay, forget about higher this. All I wanted to say is that this picture, in a way that we already saw, where you can write a metric in
D-dimensional Euclidean space, okay, here, can be conformally mapped to the metric on R times a D-1 dimensional sphere. So in the higher dimensional picture, instead of a fixed time slice being a circle, the fixed time slice is a D-1 dimensional sphere. And states evolve like spherical waves like that. Okay. So now we want to construct states in this Hilbert space. And now once we have states, we also have to define inner product in this Hilbert space. So we can talk about matrix elements of operators in the Hilbert space. So let's define first what is an instate. So again, this is a state that from this picture you would create if you are an experimental LHC. I mean, the setup is that you do something in the infinite past, you wait for a long time and you measure again. So this state in this picture would be, roughly speaking, in the cylinder picture, the way you will construct it is the limit where you go to minus infinity to the infinite path of, okay, phi is some operator, some primary operator, for simplicity now. Yeah, okay, and if you want, you can pull out the time evolution, like that. So this is how you would create an instate that you know from your field theory class. You act with a particular operator of the vacuum. Okay, so this is important. This is the vacuum. We will characterize more carefully what properties the vacuum has in the conformal field theory with respect to which operators annihilate the vacuum. But in this other picture, we create a state and infinite path. This maps to the origin. So the corresponding statement in the plane is that you have a disturbance at the origin of the complex plane produced by an operator, the corresponding operator. So this phi was an operator, right? So what you have to do is to map the state here to an instate here. What you have to do is essentially the same thing. So this is in the cylinder picture. This is in the complex plane picture at the origin. You have to take the limit. Well, this corresponds to the origin, right, of the complex plane, of phi of z, z bar. So that's how you create an instate. And the fact that you had here, remember that the conformal mapping is actually to the complex plane minus 2 points. The point that you removed is exactly the operator that you need to insert there to create the instate, okay? I hope that's something to look at, yes.
If we had two different kinds of vacuums, one was the like true vacuum for theory, and the other one was a free vacuum.
Yes, in conformal field theories, we have the luxury that we can discuss the true vacuum. So this will be the true vacuum. Of course, in perturbation theory, you usually work with the free field vacuum. That's a good question. Yes.
The second limit there, why is t going to infinity?
Why is it infinity?
Okay, so now one thing that we have to define is when we want to construct inner products and matrix elements of operators, we have to construct the bra. No, this is the bra, the ket, right? So we have to define how to do Hermitian conjugation. So let me tell you how you do it, and then I'll show you that it's a consistent definition. So if I have a operator phi, z, z bar, I want to define the conjugate operator, the Hermitian conjugate, which we take to be this, so 1 over z bar to the 2h, 1 over z to the 2h bar, phi at 1 over z bar, 1 over z. Well, remember that h and h bar are the eigenvalues of phi under L0 bar. And now, in order to show you that this is a consistent definition, I'll show you that you compute the inner product between the norm of the state created by phi, you get something sensible. So let me show you a little bit of the details. I'm not sure I should show you all the details, but I'll leave some of them. So now we want to think of an out state. So this is the guy that lives out here. And this can be obtained. You can get the ket from the bra by Hermitian conjugation. And now let's see that this is a sensible inner product. Okay? We'll have to show that this is a sensible inner product. And yes.
Okay, one thing. Why can't we define the conjugate of phi as phi of z bar and z phi?
But you'll get something nonsensical. So you'll see now that if you did anything different, you wouldn't have a good inner product. So the fact that you have to define a consistent inner product tells you what Phi Dagger has to be. I mean, I didn't, it's fixed, it's not. So let's do a little bit of analysis here. So following all the definitions that we already had. Oh dear. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm just using the original definition of what how you construct a state by an operating act on the vacuum and using this. Now I use my, for a time being, cooked up notion of Hermitian conjugation in the complex plane, for the operator leaving the complex plane. So this is the limit z, z bar. Okay, let me not write all of the time. So z w going to 0. Of z bar to the minus 2h, z to the minus 2h bar. So all I'm doing is using that definition, right? And then I have phi at 1 over z bar, 1 over z, phi w bar. And now all I do is I rewrite this by saying that I can define zeta to be 1 over z. So, okay, so the limit w equals 0, w going to 0 is completely harmless. Now we have to worry about the limit where z is going to 0 because we have all these factors left, 1 over z, so you might worry that this is blowing up. But this is nothing but zeta bar 2h, zeta 2h bar of the vacuum expectation value of phi or z bar, z, phi. If you want, I can already put 0 because there is nothing dangerous here. So I already took the w equals 0 limit. But now what you have to remember is that we know, because that's one of the things that we determined earlier, that we know how conformal symmetry fixes the two-point function of phi with itself. And it has precisely it's precisely the inverse of this. Okay. So that means that this is precisely this constant C that appeared. Remember that we had the two-point function was some constant that we have to calculate, divided by essentially z to the h, so and so on. I mean, that the position dependence was completely fixed. And what this shows us is this inner product with this notion of Hermitian conjugation precisely picks up the physical information, which is the coefficient of the two-point function. Okay? So this justifies this slightly weird-looking. There is a way of motivating this further, but maybe I'll leave that for the homework to motivate why an out state that is here can be written in a way analogous to that by knowing that you can go from here to here by doing a z to 1 over z transformation, and then using conformal a little gymnastics with conformal transformation, you'll get something like that. Okay. But let me know if this is not. Maybe I'll give you an exercise. But the real argument is that this is the only construction that gives you a well-defined inner product. Yes?
It should go to infinity?
No, because I meant... Yeah,
but this...
Oh, sorry. I meant W. Sorry. Oh, sorry. You're right. Yes. You're right. Yes. The point is that this looks like it's diverging, but it's cancelled precisely by this guy that's going to zero. Okay. What else?
Okay. Is it clear what that value C is, just for everybody?
What is it?
Is it clear to everyone that, that's what that C is? Does everybody know?
Is it clear? Okay. People are saying like that. Okay, so what else do I want to tell you? Okay, so now that we have kind of this Hilbert space structure, we know how to do Hermitian conjugation, we can start thinking about matrix elements of operators. So now let's consider, let's imagine that we have a phi of z is a so phi is a sum operator in the conformal field theory. And just like it is useful in a flat space to decompose, say, a scalar field into its Fourier modes and creation and annihilation operators, we want to have the analog of that for a conformal field theory. So something that you can do is, for if phi is a holomorphic operator, like the stress tensor, you can define it by a Lorentz series. So the sum over all integers, some Fourier modes of z minus n minus h, okay? Where h is the L naught eigenvalue. So this is just very similar to what you would do in flat space-time for a free scalar field. You would decompose it into plane waves. Here the field is holomorphic, so I can find the basis of single-valued holomorphic functions like that. And now let's see what happens to these modes. So this is the analog of A and A dagger in free field theory. Let's see what happens to them under complex conjugation. So let's take the under Hermitian conjugation, sorry. So this by definition gives me just phi and dagger, and this is just z bar to the minus n minus h, okay? But this, by this formula, is exactly the same as phi evaluated at 1 over z bar, times 1 over z bar to the 2h. All that I'm using is this, right? I'm writing phi dagger in terms of phi evaluated at 1 over z bar, and I have this Jacobian factor, z bar to the 2h. So this is an equality. And now, to get something interesting, all that I do is that I know the mode expansion of phi. So now I just apply the mode expansion of phi in this expression. So what you get is the sum over all integers of phi n. This now is evaluated at 1 over z bar. So that means this is z bar to the n plus h divided by 1 over z bar to the 2h. So in the first part, I just plugged in this equation for this term, and this guy is just this. So this is the sum over all integers of phi n z bar to the n minus h, because now I have this this plus 1 is cancelled by this minus 2, so you get a minus 1. So this implies, now I have to compare this with this, right? That's the game we're playing. And in order for this to be the same, and in order to be compared, n is running over all integers, so I can just trivially define m to be minus n. Okay, this is so trivial that maybe I'm making it more complicated than it is, but let me just, you can write it like that. So let me write it and let's see if people are happy with this.
If I'm summing over all integers, I could sum starting from plus infinity or minus infinity, okay? And now I can literally compare, because now the point is that this, okay, and now again I change to n. So now I can directly compare this expression with this expression. We see that the functional dependence is exactly the same now. That's why I did this trivial thing. So from here we conclude that phi and dagger is phi minus n. So Hermitian conjugation acts very simply on the Fourier modes of a primary operator. It just changes, it maps phi n to phi minus n. Okay? And that's why you might have said, why am I putting this weird factor, this shift by minus 8? The whole reason I did it is in such a way that Hermitian conjugation just changed this argument of n to minus n. Yeah, so right now, I'm, in a conformal theory, you can decouple what happened with Z-bar, so we're only looking at the holomorphic. Yes, yes. More questions? Okay. So in particular, one of the guys that we will use over and over again, which is the stress tensor. Remember, the stress tensor the holomorphic stress tensor, P of Z, was an object that we know it has the following properties. It has a scaling weight 2 under the holomorphic side, a scaling weight 0 under the anti-holomorphic side. So by using this general discussion, we can write down PZ in this Fourier mode. And now we define this capital Ln. These are the operators that appear in the Fourier decomposition of the stress tensor. And since it has dimension 2, we have this expression. And now let's learn a few things about the vacuum from our previous knowledge of properties of the stress energy tensor. So if we demand regularity of the stress tensor at the origin. So remember that one of the things that we did in the previous lecture is, what did we do? What do I want to say? Well, we want to make sure that the operator, the stress tensor is globally defined in the correlation function away from operator insertions. That's something that we deduce from the conformal word identities. So now I want to look at what happens as when TZ acts on the vacuum, expectation on the vacuum. So let me write this as that. So the sum over N, LN, acting on the vacuum. And so demanding that this is regular, meaning it doesn't blow up at the origin, implies that n has to be bigger than minus 1. Because, for example, if n is right? I think that's right. The other modes, what this means, sorry, I didn't finish the sentence. So if n is bigger than minus 1, then this has to be killed, not to get a singularity. Okay? So the fact that the stress tensor has to be regular at the origin implies, forces us to pick up essentially, what this tells us is that the action of these Fourier modes acting on the vacuum have to vanish for a particular value of n. Is this clear? I made it more complicated than what it is, but yes. Sorry? Okay, let's do it. So, so L minus 2, let's look at L minus 2. L minus 2 is safe, right? Because this goes like z to the 0. L minus 1, okay, so let's explore the region where things become dangerous. So you have L minus 2 is safe because it goes like z to the 0, 0, right? L minus 1 goes like 1 over z. L0 like goes like 1 over z squared, and so on, right? So all the guys like that have to annihilate the vacuum. That's all I'm saying. Was this clear? I mean, that's okay. So in particular, it means that the vacuum in a conformal field theory, in particular, is annihilated by L0, L1, and L minus 1. And actually, if we did exactly the same exercise for the anti-holomorphic stress tensor, we would find exactly the same thing for L0 bar, L1 bar, and L minus 1 bar. Which is these are the ones that generate, in fact, as we will see later more explicitly. So remember that in the lecture we showed that the vector fields associated to global conformal transformations generate SL2C. And the point is that these guys satisfy exactly the same relation, okay? And these guys, which are the... forget about the name. So the point is that these are associated. These are the operators associated with globally defined vector fields. And in particular, and they form an algebra by itself. It's the algebra of global conformal transformations. And it tells you that these generators kill the vacuum. Okay? But it's also very important that all the negative modes, in a way, all the positive modes, like ln acting on the vacuum for positive n, annihilate the state. So what this will tell us is that if you want to that the operators in this other tower, L minus n, will play an important role. This will be like the raising operators. So ln with n positive are like the lowering operators, and ln with n negative will be like the raising operators. We will see this in a few minutes.
Something that is annihilated by all the talks about.
Well, that's what you define. You define it as a state that if you have the stress tensor has no singularity, and in particular is annihilated by...
Okay.
So now, one of the things that we have to confront at some point is understand what is the... So we're doing conformal field theory, and the stress tensor is the central object in the story. But now we're using this language of operators acting on the Hilbert space with creation and annihilation operators. So we have to understand what is the algebra generated by these elements. Anyway, we want to identify more clearly, even though that really was an important hint, which of the modes here are raising operators and which ones are lowering operators. Okay. But to do that, I have to make a slight detour. Okay. So let me first remind you of something that hopefully are a bit familiar. If not, I can try to explain. But one thing I want to emphasize. So the first statement is, remember that we said that the charge, the conserved charge, associated with conformal transformations was this contour integral. So that's something that we derived two lectures ago, right? So it was the integral of dz, epsilon z, dz. So this was some contour integral in the complex plane. So you can take it like that. Epsilon z was the vector field that tells you what is the conformal transformation we're talking about. And this was the conserved charge associated to that. Are people happy with this? This is general structure that we always had, that we integrate the conserved current over some fixed time slice. And now notice that even though we saw it directly in that case, now you can understand in what sense, why am I doing in this complex plane picture an integral over the Z plane? Because essentially, this is whenever you construct the conserved charge associated to a current, what you have to do is integrate the current, the zeroth component of the current, around a fixed time slice. But not a fixed time slice, it's just an integral over this contour. Yes? We will. No, because if you're careful about the conjuration, you don't. We will see that. So this is the conserved charge associated to conformal transformations, and the fact that it's a contour integral in the complex plane is just that we're integrating over our initial value surface, a fixed initial value surface, which is what conserved charges. That's how you construct conserved charges, by fixing what your time slicing is and integrating over space in that fixed time slicing. Okay? And then in this operator language, on the right-hand side, maybe here. We can ask, how do you identify how an operator transforms under a particular symmetry? And the point is that if you act with a particular transformation, in this case it's a conformal transformation, but this is true for everything. It's true for, it's also in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. If you do this, the transformation of an operator under some symmetry is the commutator of the corresponding conserved charge times the operator. Is this, should I explain this more or? Okay. I'm wondering how careful a derivation I should be. So let me say it first more colloquially, and then if you want to. This follows, and you can show this from the word identity. That we described in two lectures ago. But one way you can think about this is the following, is that think of just conventional quantum mechanics. Okay? So symmetries in quantum mechanics are realized on the Hilbert space by a unitary operator. Okay? So for example, time evolution. is implemented by operator U, which is e to the IST, right? Now, the point is that under, so, and think of now we're doing quantum mechanics in the Heisenberg picture, where the operators are the ones that depend on space and time. And the point now is that you have an operator A, and you make a Smith transformation. So under a Smith transformation, you change the wave function psi, go to some psi prime, right, which is U of psi. So the symmetry is implemented on the superspace by some unitary operator U. A unitary operator is one that has the property that U times the dielectric of 1. And if you have an observable A, O, in your theory, which acts on state, if you make a unitary transformation, if you make a symmetry transformation, the operator rotates in this way. In such a way that the matrix element, so such that, I mean, the reason it's in that way is that under a Smith transformation, the physical observable should not change. But these are the matrix elements of it's the expectation value of certain operators, all like that. Okay? But this is exactly the same as that, right? So that's why symmetries are implemented by unitary operators that rotate the observables by conjugation, like this. Okay. So far, and this you know from think of the Heisenberg picture, where you have the x of tau is e to the ix tau, x of 0 is e to the minus ix tau. Okay. But this is very general. This is whatever you have a symmetry, you can always think of it like that. And now, what I want to say is. So U is a unitary operator. So again, just even in classical mechanics, a conserved a symmetry has a continuous symmetry has an associated conserved charge Q. So for example, you have time evolution. Q would be the Hamiltonian. You have translational symmetry. You have the Q is the momentum generator, and so on. More and then you write U as e to the I H T. In this case, U here e to the I P I X I. Right? You did something, right? But in general. I mean, and just to be super explicit, so this is nothing but the fact that if you change x to x prime, you can represent it as e to the ixt x e to the minus ixt. This is the Heisenberg evolution operator. More generally, when you have a symmetry, U is a unitary operator, and you can always write a unitary operator like this as e to the I times q. U is unitary, so it means that U times U dagger, here there is an infinitesimal parameter, so let's say that A is the size of the transformation, it's like the analog of T, how much of a transformation you've made, and then the fact that, and let's look at now an infinitesimal version of this, the fact that U is unitary implies that Q is Hermitian. So that's why in quantum mechanics, conserved charges are Hermitian operators in the Kluber space. And then all that I'm doing in order to get this kind of picture is we've implemented a symmetry transformation and we have U phi U inverse because U dagger is U inverse. Now let's expand this to let's make an infinitesimal transformation. This is what we're doing here, right? We're making a small transformation. So all that I have to do is expand the exponential here to leading order in the parameter A. So what you get is And to leading order in A, what you get is phi, right? Because you just get 1, plus precisely the commutator, because you get one term from here where you have q times phi times 1, and another where you have 1 times phi times minus q. So you get plus I q phi. Okay? So that means that phi transforms under a similar transformation, which is phi prime minus phi, as I q phi. So that's why in any symmetry in a quantum theory is implemented by a unitary operator in the Hilbert space, and it acts on the operator when you make an infinitesimal transformation by the commutator of that Hermitian operator, which is the charge, with the corresponding operator. Is this clear? Okay. So all this detour was just to justify this, okay? There is a way of, if you want to be ambitious, you can try to derive this from the word identity. It's not hard. It follows directly from, remember that at some point, okay, maybe I can give you a hint of how to do it in one of the exercises. But it follows directly from that master formula and choosing a clever contour of integration on the word identity, you will exactly recover this. And I think it's important that you try to do that in that language to see that everything I'm telling you is consistent. Okay. So now the point is that let's go back to this. Remember that I'm going to this detour because I want to compute the commutation relations of these lines, okay? But in order to compute that, the way I will compute it is by essentially relating this to the singularity structure of the operator product. So let me try to explain this. So I want to show that delta epsilon phi, which is q phi, can be related to the singularities. So this is q at some point w. Singularities that appear in the product p of z with phi of w. Okay? So let me see. And remember, so now what I'll do is write this, and to be more precise, this should, okay. Let me write this in the following, using the following trick. So let me write and then I'll explain. So it's the integral from z bigger than w minus the integral of z less than w. Dz times, so, and now I'm doing something a bit more general. I'm allowing Q to be any conserved current. There's nothing special about the stress tensor, just using any conserved current where J of Z is a conserved current. Okay. And here, remember that operators, whenever we're in the Hamiltonian pictures, operators have to be radially ordered. Whenever I have an operator expression, it has to be ordered. But let me not write the symbol very explicitly, but where this is gz phi of w, okay? So all I did is use the fact that q is a contour integral of the current, and I use the fact that this guy has two terms, okay? And now this symbol just means that I do the following integral with the following contour. So I have w, which is where my operator phi is. And it's a contour, so I'm doing an integral over z, right? So this is a Z contour that goes slightly, it's always slightly bigger than Z, okay? So that's why Z is bigger than W. And this is the contour to have here. Where it's the other way around. So I do a contour. And now I always stay slightly below. W. So one way of thinking about this is that when I write this formula, these operators have to be radially ordered. Yes.
When you obtain the commutator,
yeah,
there should be a A.
Yes, sir. Yes. Depends where you can put sometimes the A in the queue or pull it out. Okay. No, the key point I wanted to stress is that it's a commutator. So this commutator has two terms, right? One where you have Q times 5, and the other one you have 5 times Q. The operators are always radially ordered, so it means that in the first term, the tap Q comes later than 5, so that's why we integrate Z is bigger than the location of 5. And for the other term, since 5 is on the left and Q is on the right, Z has to be smaller than the location of W. And now what I do is I'm subtracting the same integral, and now I have a difference of two contours, and you can convince yourself that this is nothing but the... The only thing that survives is this. Everything else cancels far away from this region. And essentially what you get is, just as two contours, the difference of these contours is nothing but the integral of Z around the point of it. So what we have shown is that the variation of the field with the commutator can be written as a contour CW. Let me call this contour CW. Where I just think of making, I have my point W where my operator is, and I make a very small contour that surrounds that point. I call this CW. Of the product JZ phi W. So let's just write it the final glorious formula. So you should go, I mean, later, just think by yourself that in fact what I'm saying here is correct and simple. But let's. Okay? So this is a very interesting formula because it tells us, first of all, in order for this contour, integral to be non-trivial, I only get something non-zero if I have a singularity in this OPE, okay? Because if here I have an analytic function, maybe I should remind you of the, if this is just an analytic function, I can just deform the contour and I get zero. So that means that the variation of the field is picked up by the poles in the product of GZ with phi W. Okay. And we'll see now a couple of examples just to become more familiar. But is the spirit of this clear? The point is that we've related commutators of operators, which is the reason I'm going through this, because I want to compute ultimately the commutator of these operators. I've related the commutator of these operators to two things. One, to the variation of the operator with respect to a conformal transformation, and two, to the operator for the expansion between two operators. And we will be using the languages back and forth. Yeah.
Operator or Is J already an operator or phi?
J is an operator. Everything is an operator.
the construct current is an operator. I'm not sure what the question is.
Yeah, why doesn't have a set principle you can take it out? Wasn't proper.
No, you cannot. There is a injury. You cannot move it out of the contour. The point is that you should think of this as an operator product, and this height has an expansion to be a function of z minus w. So you're not fooling that, yeah?
So are there time ordering, is there time ordering like implicit anywhere?
Yes.
Yes.
Everything is.
Okay.
Everything is. It's not. It's readily ordered. That's why I was telling you that one, the radius of this of right. Z is always
radial.
Everything. Whenever we're talking about operators in the plane, everything is readily ordered. Okay. So let me give you a simple example of this kind of information. What kind of information we can extract out of this before we move to the more relevant case of the data sort of algebra, which is the algebra generated by these elements. So let me give an example. So if I is a primary operator, which is the thing we've been discussing at length before. We know that the infinitesimal conformal transformation parameterized by some vector field epsilon is h times the derivative of epsilon plus epsilon times the derivative acting on phi. This was, remember, the part that came from just translations, where you have the derivative of the field times by how much you shifted the field. And then there is the part that was the spin part that knows about the internal quantum numbers, which is H. Okay. So now we have the following equation. It tells us that the product of this Z. Oh, by the way, whenever I write this Z, this symbol, I have implicit divided by 2 pi I, which is the, I'll remind you now of Cauchy's formula, but whenever I write this as a definition, I mean really would either 2 pi I times thing. Okay? This is a small detail, but this tells us that the product of epsilon z qz, so I'm using this formula, right? So times phi w. This is the right-hand side of this formula. The left-hand side, we know. So this is h the epsilon plus epsilon derivative acting on phi. Tells us this. Okay. Oh, what did I? Here is t, right? I'm just checking you. This should be t. That epsilon t is the current for conformal transformation. So now, if you remember, so the slogan I was telling you is that the commutator or the transformation can be obtained from the singularities that appear in the product of tz with phi w. And now I want to remind you of this formula. So I have a point z naught, and I do a contour integral that goes around this point z naught. And something that you've seen, hopefully, before, is that this formula so this the denominator here, you have a pole of order n at z naught, and this integral is the nth minus 1 derivative of the function, holomorphic function f of z here, evaluated at the location of the pole. And I think I have some factorials. That, I think the factorial is like that. Okay? People are not disturbed by such formula, right?
Okay. So now we have to cook up, just by inspection, we can cook up which is the product of TZ with phi W, such that, and using this contour integral, such that we will get this piece. And it would be nice for you to check. It's very simple what I'm doing, but we can almost check it explicitly here, so that TZ times phi W will have to be H divided by Z minus W square times phi W. So in this business, I mean, in this OPE, which term in the right-hand side does this particular expression reproduce? Someone can say? So, it's kind of obvious, I told you what H is, but I want you to understand. So, plus things that are regular. So things that have no pole as Z hits W. So notice now that if I plug this into here and use this formula. So let's look first at the term that has a simple pole. A simple pole, the Cauchy theorem tells you that you have a function with a simple pole, N equals 1. Then all that you have to do is evaluate the function at the location of the pole. So all that I have to do is, in this product, evaluate this guy and this guy at the pole. So, and this is precisely this. Okay? So and this term, now we have to fish for this term. So the first thing to notice is that here we have a derivative, okay? So in order to get a derivative, we need, first of all, a double pole because of this formula, right? So that's why the coefficient of H has to be a double pole, such that when I apply this relation, I have to differentiate once this, okay? And therefore, that's why I say by inspection, you can go from this formula. Eventually, so this takes some gymnastics to become familiar with, but eventually you'll be very good at given a contour integral of a product of operators equals something, you'll be able to tell me the singular part of the product of the operator, just because you know this formula. And you can read it off, okay? And notice that this argument doesn't tell us anything yet about the regular parts. We will have a lot to say about the regular part later, but that will have to wait a little bit. So now let me give you maybe one example and then I'll quit. Probably it's not good that I start with the Virasoro algebra now, yes?
This middle black part, you said that time ordering is implicit?
Yes.
But if you take the time ordering of a anti-commutator of two operators, doesn't it give zero? Because under time ordering, the order doesn't tell, and we always rearrange so that first time comes first.
No, but okay. Is it anti-commutator?
Yeah, because.
These are commutators, right?
Commutators, sorry. The time ordering of a commutator to operate.
No, but the problem is that you have to think of. First of all, one thing that I was a bit troubled with is that this is the equal time commutator. So the way you think about this is that you first, one of the terms, one time is slightly above the other one. So if you wish, do the integral where, so you're at W, and in one place you do the first term is where W is slightly, I don't know which convention I'm using, which goes before or after, but the point is, one of them is slightly before, when you integrate Z comes a little before W, and the second term is exactly the opposite. I'm not sure this is the question you have, I don't know. So this is one contour, and this is the other. And this is what this was meant to describe. Yeah, so you define it as a limit. Because notice that this thing, yeah, you have to be careful, because there could be other operators. So here I'm focusing on two operators that I have there, but there could be other ones. So you have to define it as a limit of one that comes slightly before and one that becomes slightly after. So in fact, I mean, one thing that if you're careful in the derivation using this, the commutator is an equal time commutator, and it's defined exactly as this limit. Maybe it's better if I stop, because I'm kind of restart next time with recapping this and then showing you how we can use this technique to compute the Virasoro algebra generated by these guys. And once we know the algebra generated by this, which will be kind of a generalization, yes. No, epsilon z is an arbitrary holomorphic function of z. Yes. Yeah. So take a basis. I'm taking a basis. I mean, with singularity and this. Well, you can have a singularity at the origin. Well, taking Z to putting this guy on top of each other is something you have to be very, very careful, because you're bringing two operators on top of each other. And that's why you have to be very careful. I mean, this is kind of a very singular thing to do. You're bringing two operators on top of each other. And strictly speaking, we never quite let Z hit W. That's the point. So you do an expansion where Z is very, very close to W, but not on W. So that's why what you're saying doesn't happen. If you let that, then this is meaningless. I mean, you get some crap. Any more questions?
So next time we will use this to understand better the Hilbert space of CFDs. And then we'll move on to concrete models where we can use all these kind of general technology to understand the physics.
Thank you.